All right, so thank you very much. I'm really pleased to be here, and I commented earlier that I can either dwell a lot on the slides and go over time, or I can zip through them and finish early, and I'll try to have sort of a happy medium, but I don't know. I really love this material that I'm talking about. So it's correct that this title, I actually put, "What Can We Mathematicians Say After We've Said We're Sorry for This?" And you'll see the significance of that as I go along. So I'm very grateful to the MA for inviting me to speak. I have to say that, you know, when you're invited to give a talk like this, you think, oh, I'm going to cover a lot of material. I'm going to go through this great thing. You realize you'd have a five-hour lecture. So I'm going to concentrate on my own experiences when I talk about this title. But I want to explain. Now, it's based on an old song, but it's not country and western. It's by Walter Donaldson and Abe Lyman. It appeared in 1926. The lines are, "What can I say, dear? What can I do after I say I'm sorry?" This song, this is all, of course, from the web, sung by Ella Fitzgerald. I just remember this title, and I thought it was sort of appropriate. Ella Fitzgerald, Frank Sinatra, many other well-known singers have sung this song. I'm not aware of any rap singers that have done it, but maybe they could. Okay, so what is that song title saying? It says, what can I say, what can I do after I say I'm sorry? So the first thing is to apologize. You know, you say you're sorry. And then the singer is sort of trying to make up for whatever he or she did, wanting to take action after apologizing. So how is this related to mathematics, you ask? So here are two of my opinions. One, it expresses the reaction of, and I'm going to be a bit provocative here, of a responsible mathematician. Not all mathematicians are responsible. To the often huge gap that exists between the important real-world problems that people want and need to solve. Okay, so there are all these real-world problems that people want to solve, need to solve. And then there are the problems that can actually be solved in a mathematical sense. And, you know, I said in the abstract, I think just saying, I'm sorry, that's impossible. Even if you say it politely, even if you're really not, I don't think that's enough. So you want to do like the song, what can I do, what can I say, after I say I'm sorry. So why is there a gap? Okay, well, you know, I like to quote from famous people. No one actually knows if Yogi Berra really said this, but it's such a great quote and he gets credit for it, so let's give it to him. So in theory, there's no difference between theory and practice, in practice there is. And this is really true as all of us who've ever thought about real world problems know. Okay, you have theory and then there's the real world and they don't match. So I'm going to focus on the area of optimization, which happens to be my research area, because many real-world problems are posed in terms of optimizing, meaning finding the best of something. For example, what's the best airplane design? What's the best stock portfolio? What's the most efficient way to route trains? What's the optimal molecular configuration for a new material? What's the best design of a particle accelerator? And on and on and on. Many classical mathematical problems are posed in terms of optimizing, but many real-world problems are as well. So this comes up a lot. So, of course, I used Google to check on this. So as of a few days ago, the word optimization, 113 million hits. Optimal, 70 million. Optimize, 46 million. It's a very, very popular topic. And if you look at those numbers, you might think, gosh, this is great. You know, the world is optimizing. They're all using mathematics. Isn't that wonderful? Now, I really only chose one of these, but I thought this was good. This is called the Optimize! Institute. And if you look, they deal with communication, conflict, anger, negotiation, team building, etc. And you can see their peak performance. And if you look at the website, it's really quite fascinating. Okay, so I thought this was good, and in fact, that is trademarked, the Optimize! Institute. I wish I had thought of that. But anyway, this is one thing that's on the web, and it's not really about math. Okay, so if we're talking about math, what does optimization mean? So it should mean that we're having some problem. We have some objective function of which we're trying to find the largest or the smallest value, and there may be constraints on the problem. That's sort of the form. And it should mean finding, we could have an analytic form, or computing a highly accurate optimal solution. Possibly a global solution, meaning there are a lot of local optima, and we want the best one. But in practice, in many, many practical situations, you can't do this. You have no hope of achieving this first thing, which is the mathematical meaning of optimization. You can get a solution that's good enough, and it's in quotes, because that is not a precisely defined term mathematically. It depends on the problem. Sometimes better enough, meaning we have some solution to this problem and we need something that's better. It doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't even have to be very much better, just better enough. So that's what optimization can mean in practice. And here are some of the questions that are mathematical that you would want to answer about an optimization problem. Is there an optimum? Is it unique? So if you're trying to minimize x cubed, the obvious answer is it's minus infinity. It's unbounded below. So we say there's no optimum. Minimize sine x. Well, there are a lot of local minima of sine x, but there's not just one. So that's the first thing. Does there exist a solution? Is it unique? What are the properties of a solution? Well, this is very interesting. Because in math classes, you learn about tests for optimality and so on. So you think, well, I know, there's seats up here, if anyone just came in. How can we recognize? So if we're seeking this optimum, it would really be good if we could tell we'd found it. You know, these are some issues that people often don't think about in math classes. How do we test for optimality? It may be that the tests that we would have to use for optimization can't be carried out. So how are we going to say, yes, we found an optimal solution? And finally, how can we find a solution? So we presumably want to find it, if it's a real-world application, we want to find it in some reasonable period of time. And most people, in my experience, don't have a very reasonable definition of reasonable. You know, they want you to get that solution right now. And they want it to be reliable. They not only want you to get it quickly, they want you to say, this is absolutely guaranteed to be the optimal solution, not realizing that those two things trade off against each other. And with enough accuracy. So they might say, I want you to find it quickly. I want you to find it with guaranteed 16-digit accuracy. Well, you know, that's not always possible, unless you're minimizing x squared or something like that. I mean, very few people come in with problems like that. Okay, so here are some judgmental questions. So those were sort of mathematical questions, you know, how do we recognize a solution? How can we compute it? These are qualitative questions, judgmental questions. Are we solving the right problem? Okay, are we actually solving the problem we want to solve? And you'll see later that this isn't always clear. I think a lot of real-life mathematics involves formulating the problem. Okay, because people come in, they say, I want to do this. Then you, the mathematician, have to start pressing them and saying, well, exactly what do you mean by this? And how do you define that? And so on and so forth. How do we prove we've succeeded? And this is not proof in the sense of we're going to write down a theorem or even a lemma. It's to say, we're done. We've got the answer that you want. You know, we can show that it's the correct answer. And this is often very difficult. How far wrong can we be? Okay, we're supposedly solving this problem, but maybe the answer is wrong. Could it be wrong? We would like to think it would never be wrong because we're so smart, but maybe we are wrong. Can we be wrong? And can we fail? So we are going to have some optimization problem, we're going to attempt to solve it, and actually we may not be able to do that. And if that's the case, we should know about that and be prepared for it and have a backup plan. How much accuracy can be guaranteed? Well, that's always an important question. And what are the sensitivities? This is a problem that's very mathematical. If we have something and we perturb it slightly, maybe the data that they gave you about this new molecule isn't quite right. How much will that change the optimal solution? It's very, very important to know if you perturb the data, if you perturb the form of the problem. someone comes in and says, I have this quadratic function. You go ahead, you figure out something for a quadratic function. Then they come in, they say, actually, I forgot this other term. That's an exponential and other things. And you say, okay, all right, fine. I mean, it's humorous, but it's also something you just have to be ready for. Okay, so now I'm taking an example from 20 years ago. Some of you are not even this old, and I apologize, but some of you are. So this is when I was working at Stanford, and this was my first exposure to what I regard as a great optimization problem. So we were approached, I was working with a group, about commissioning. This is a term I never understood. It sort of means recalibrating a high-energy particle accelerator, the Stanford Linear Accelerator, SLAC, which is this 2-mile-long, dead-straight tube, 4 inches in diameter, near Stanford. And if any of you have been to Stanford and have driven along Highway 280, you drive over SLAC. Okay, they drive over this tube. I'm going to show you a picture in a second. So it opened in 1966. They did a lot of great stuff there, discovered quarks and charm, the tau lepton, and so on. It's got a wonderful website, and it's really a great place. So this is the brochure about SLAC. This is actually, this thing is the beam. Okay, so this is the beam. This is this outer shell. And this is their glossy brochure that talks about the work that they do there. This is what SLAC looks like from the air. Okay, so this is Highway 280. This is the 2-mile-long thing. There was a lot of discussion of the earthquake safeness of this terrain. This is earthquake country, right? And they had a freeway going over this multi-million dollar linear accelerator. They wanted to be sure it was safe. It's been fine so far. So anyway, you can see this is the 2-mile-long piece. And there's a lot more that goes on at SLAC now. But the part I was involved with was the so-called beam line. So this is in 86, 87. What was the problem? So at that time, and I don't know the situation now, but at that time, the beam could only be on, meaning this beam of electrons could only be running half the year. Electricity was so expensive at that time, I don't even like to think what it costs now, but it was so expensive that they could not keep the beam running for the whole year. So they had it on for 6 months, and then they would turn it off for 6 months, presumably do other stuff, look at the data they collected, and so on. Or occasionally, the beam would be turned off, they had to repair something wasn't working right. So there were these regular occurrences where the electricity was off. And then would come the great moment when they turned the electricity on. But guess what? The beam wouldn't be straight. Okay, because it had been sitting there, you know, it hadn't been used. It's an extremely complex piece of engineering. And so they had to get it straight again. So that's what commissioning means. It means get it back to be straight. If there are any physicists here, yeah.
During the 6 months when it's on, do they periodically have to sort of feather it or something to keep it straight?
Right. I'll get to that. And in fact, this brilliant graphic on the board is sort of showing. I couldn't really make a slide out of that. But yes, so they have to adjust it, but they really do try to leave it on because shutting it down is very, very complicated. I mean, you can imagine just from seeing the side of it. Okay, so that was the commissioning problem. So how is the beam steered? Okay, so they have these, this is where my wonderful picture comes in. So this is my depiction, I won't say artist's depiction. This is the beam line, this is 4 inches in diameter. So it has two things in it. It has magnets placed at regular intervals, which can be adjusted physically, their strength can be adjusted, and they can be moved around. I should draw the, this is a beam line, beam of electrons going through. And then there are monitors, that's what these green things are supposed to represent, which check how straight it is. So during the time it's operational, they might have to make minor adjustments to these. And you can imagine, I mean, it's very highly engineered, and they check all the time to see how things are going. But anyway, that's, you know, a rough picture. I would apologize to any particle physicist here who is here. So they said, you know, we'd like to get the beam to be straight again. So you think of an optimization problem. You think, what are the variables we can optimize? Okay, so the magnets inside the beam can be adjusted. They control if it's going straight or not. And you can adjust the power and the angle while the beam is running. Okay? How do we know if the beam is straight? So it's the, you know, the little monitors that are there. And their locations are fixed, and they monitor how the beam is doing. Okay, so those are the things. So we have the variables we're going to try to optimize, and we have some way, because we're trying to improve or optimize the straightness of the beam, we have a way to tell how that works. So this is one of my favorite things. Before 1987, how did they do this? They called it knobbing. Knobbing, manual knobbing, and they had a very skillful set of people. I like to picture them in some way as, you know, hardcore physicists who sat at the controls, and they would twiddle the magnets one at a time. That's how they did it. So they would turn the beam on, the beam wouldn't be straight, and these people would sit there adjusting the magnets one at a time. Now, this is very appealing intuitively. I want to make it very clear that when humans optimize things, we do it one thing at a time. If you're seasoning your soup, you do not take 10 spices, pour them in at the same time in different quantities, and then test it. You put the salt in, you taste the salt, then you put the pepper in, then you taste the pepper. You do it one at a time until you get it right. It's not the most efficient way to do it mathematically, but it's very satisfying intuitively. Okay, so that's how they did it, knobbing. But it took a long time. For example, usually to get the beam back on track, it would take weeks with operators doing this knobbing, working 8-hour shifts for a long time. And, you know, they would just keep going and keep going and keep going. So that wasn't a very good thing, because the weeks that they were trying to make it go straight took up some of the time they should have been doing their physics experiment. Okay, now, remember, what can I say after I say I'm sorry? So a physicist at Slack, who had actually heard me give a talk about optimization and how great it was, shows how you have to be careful, came to our group in the operations research department and said, well, I heard you give this talk, and it sounded like you can solve problems with optimization, so this is what we'd like you to do. We'd like you to optimize the settings of the magnets so the beam is straight again. Well, I mean, that's impossible. It's impossible, right? So we could have said, sorry, we oversold it, you know, too bad, knobbing works, okay, don't worry. Because it's really impossible. The structures, just modeling the beam line, you can imagine, is extremely complex, extremely complicated. Optimization problems that are nice tend to have convex objective functions. This objective function was not convex to adjust the magnets. And there were constraints that I'm not really going to go into, because there are fixed positions of the magnets and monitors. You can't, you know, sort of say, let's move this magnet down a few feet while the beam is running. I mean, you can't really do that. And there were other operational conditions. But we thought we should try something. You know, we should do something. These were a great group of Slack physicists. They really wanted to use optimization. We decided it would be pretty stupid, you know, for us to tell them that their problem was impossible and that they should go away. So we said, well, we don't promise anything. Don't promise anything, but we're going to try to help you. So traditionally, when mathematicians address real-world problems, the very first thing they do is reformulate the problem, right? They say, well, you have this complicated problem. I'm going to start with this simple problem. So that's what we did. So we really lowered the expectations. And we didn't say, yes, we're going to find an automatic optimization algorithm that is going to solve the commissioning problem. We said we're going to find, quote, optimal, and I put quotes because it wasn't really optimal, to adjust the beam so that the observed data matches model predictions as closely as possible in a least square sense. So in a second, I'll mention they had a very good model of how the beam behaved. very good model, very good understanding of the physics. And we were planning to identify errors in the physical systems. So one of the things you could see could happen there, suppose one of the magnets went on the blink, didn't work correctly anymore. Okay, so how would you ever be able to tell that if you can't go in there, take it out, and do this? So we were going to try to use optimization to identify, and this is actually a very tricky problem, which again we didn't solve exactly, which things might be wrong. Okay, so we were going to look at the problem, we were going to say, you know, we're not sure about the data this one monitor is giving us. It just doesn't seem consistent with everything else. So we had many physical systems that could have errors. So undetected misalignments, there might be a shift in strength, lots of bad things could happen. So what were the crucial problem features? Very well understood physics. This was really fantastically well understood. They had a very accurate mathematical model of how the beam behaved. Okay, so it had been tried, they had experimental data, they could show that their mathematical model was excellent. Second, extremely high precision data that could be taken at will. So they could say, give us the data to show this, give us the data to show that. They controlled the beam line. It's an experimental machine, in effect. It's a very large experimental machine. It's an experimental machine. And the other thing that we had is we worked extremely closely with these great physicists and SLAC systems engineers. So, I mean, as I say, this was really a lot of fun, and they wanted this to succeed, and we wanted it to succeed, and we were all eager to make it work. So we met very frequently, learned a lot about what they were doing. They learned a lot about optimization. It was a great collaboration. So we devised something that was new then. It's certainly not new now. There's a class of methods called sequential quadratic programming, or SQP, for solving problems with a nonlinear objective function and nonlinear constraints. So we came up with a special form of an SQP algorithm that said the objective function is a nonlinear least squares problem, because we were trying to match this data, and special structure in the constraints. So, hooray. The result, after a long time, was that the time to commission went down to 1 8-hour shift. So we were very happy. Now I want to mention some things that were interesting that I had not really known might happen. First of all, they'd been using knobbing for a while. I mean, this, you know, 20 years or something. So they knew that it worked. Okay, so here are some physicists who say, I don't know if we trust you. You know, some crazed mathematician comes in and says, use Newton's method to do this. You know, and they think, wait, you know, there's this very expensive piece of equipment. So we had to convince them that this made sense, and we would never have been able to do that without these physicists who were sort of on our side and could go and talk to their friends and use physics language and stuff. They didn't say SQP, they said other things, and they believed them. And another really important thing is, think about it, here's SLAC. Here are these people that say, we have this new way that we're going to, you know, solve this difficult problem. Let us run the machine for a while. Let us take over. I mean, it wasn't us, but it was our colleague. Well, you know what I mean? We, of course, didn't get this right the first time. We had to keep refining it. We had to keep changing it. We had our software running up there. And, you know, they were very nervous, you know, I mean, they thought we might break something or wreck something or, you know, make it damage so badly they would never get it straight again. I mean, they really were reluctant, and it was a tribute to our colleagues in physics that, you know, they did that. I mean, they said, all right, we believe you, it's worth a try, and I mean, it was running all the time, and I can assure you we didn't get to do anything serious first, okay? They didn't just say, okay, Margaret, take over the controls. I mean, that would have been kind of fun, but you know, they didn't do that. So so we did have to try it with the beam running to get this to work. And again, when you're working on real-world applications, you know, you normally cannot just prove a theorem and say, here it is, this is what you want. If you're producing something to solve a problem, you have to try it on the real problem. Of course, and that's when you discover that something you thought was true isn't true, something they told you, an assumption, isn't right. So So it was a great collaboration for us. And in particular, there were four of us who were optimizers, so we wrote research papers about this. Of course, for mathematicians, this is the number one thing, right? We had new insights into how these SQP methods work because the way the slack problem behaved was very unusual. We had never seen some of the particular form of the non-convexities before. And in my opinion, I should have put my opinion, if you work on real-world problems, you'll almost always get new mathematics. Okay, in my opinion, if you don't, there's something wrong with you. Okay, because even the most apparently simple real-world problem has twists and nuances and interesting things that you would not expect. We were able to improve this general SQP method, so even though we did a special one for slack, we improved the general one that we had, and that was nice. Plus, every time I drive by slack, I just kind of smile, you know, I think. Now, they probably don't use it anymore. It was 20 years ago. And that's a satisfaction, you know, proving theorems is nice, getting things to run is nice, but seeing an actual realization of what you've done is very exciting. So all of us that worked on this love it when we drive by slack and we go there and we feel this warm, fuzzy feeling about, you know, this particle accelerator. Okay. Second example. It's only about 10 years old, and this is from my work at AT&T Bell Laboratories. It was AT&T Bell Laboratories at the time I first... Now it's Lucent Alcatel. But at the time, it was AT&T. So I was working in the Computing Science Center there, but we were very closely tied. Numerical analysis is in the Computing Center at Bell Labs, or was, because of Hamming, okay, a name some of you may know. He was in the Computing Center. So people that worked in that area were in the Computing Center, along with people that developed Unix and C and C++ and all these other great computing things. So the problem was to design an indoor wireless communication system. So what does this mean? Cell phones, you know, wireless networks in buildings, shelf tags. The idea of this would be if you're in a store and the products all have little tags on them and you decide to have a sale, you can automatically change the prices of the items, and then when they run it through their cash register, the price is different. You know, you don't have to run around and put new stickers, or if you decide to raise the prices of all the items. Active badges. This is an area which some people find a little offensive, you know, that you would wear a badge and they can find you. Okay, you know, so you're wandering around the building, they say, I don't know where he is, I think he's in a meeting, and they could say, no, he's not in a meeting, he's wherever. So the result of this was what's called WISE, wireless system engineering. It's still being used at Alcatel-Lucent, to my great joy. Okay, you can still find people using WISE. Okay, so that's great, I think. So this was a multidisciplinary collaboration, like the one at Slack. This included these people. Steve Fortune did the computational geometry. David Gay did the modeling languages. Brian Kernahan wrote the user interfaces and did the system integration. Orlando Landron took the measurements. I'll say a little more about that. Ronaldo Valenzuela did the radio engineering, and I did the optimization. So this was a fantastic experience. I just can't tell you. And I know people would say, don't admit you were having fun. You know, say, don't tell the executives that you were having fun. Say that it was really hard. And it was really hard, but it was also fun. And we all had a ball. So this is one of the biggest customers, Home Depot, who wanted to buy, you know, an indoor wireless system, and they wanted Lucent to install it. So this is a picture that I took from the web of a Home Depot. Maybe some of you can identify this. I don't remember where it is. This is a picture of inside Home Depot. What I want you to notice here is, so we're going to have to build a mathematical model of radio propagation. Ignoring the customer, you know, there are all these metal shelves, there's stuff here, there are ladders. Home Depots have a very specific structure that they all use. It's not easy. I mean, it's not simple. It's very complicated if you actually tried to model every shelf and every post and so on and so forth. So we started working on this project. And here's a very early lesson we learned. If we went in and showed our equations to the management, they were not impressed. You know, we'd say, look, we have this great way of calculating radio propagation, this great way of doing, I hear minimize f of x, blah, blah. No. So pictures are needed. You need pretty pictures that people who are not expert in the field can understand. Okay, I mean, this is absolutely essential. And I think too few mathematicians appreciate this. You know, they think everybody's as interested as they are in the equations, and they fail to recognize that not everybody is so interested in math, and they may not even understand the equations. Try to go to a talk on advanced organic chemistry sometime and see, you know, how much you get out of it. It's sometimes pretty small. You think, I wish they'd show me something that I can understand. So I think this is sort of a general lesson about what you need to do when you're communicating what you do. So this is an example. This is an example of Brian's user interface. So this is Home Depot, and you might recognize it a little bit from the picture. So the colors of these walls represent different materials. So some are metal, there's wood, there's concrete, and so on and so forth. You can see the structures here. I think this may be the cash register on the way out. Anyway, this is the way that a Home Depot looked, okay? And I'm not even going to talk about this problem, but one thing we had to think about was, how do we express this building mathematically? You know, how are we going to get this information in, let alone display it in an interesting way? So the first problem was impossible. This one is, I know this isn't grammatically correct, more impossible than the beam problem. It's much harder. It's much messier. So first of all, remember I said with the slag problem, there was an excellent physical model. They had a great model of the physics. Even radio engineers who have worked in the field for years, and that's what Rinaldo had done, said, we don't really understand radio propagation in buildings. It can't be modeled to high accuracy. So they would show us these so-called models of the wireless, and we would say, what's this gamma sub Q? Oh, it's this factor we put in. You know, what's this alpha sub B? It's a factor to adjust for whatever. And we call those fudge factors, right? I mean, they look better if they're Greek letters, but the fact is, you know, the fact is they are fudge factors in the model. And so in contrast to the slack problem, we had some model of radio propagation, but it's not 100%. It's not very accurate at all. And this is, remember I said for slack, we could take measurements whenever we wanted to. So we wanted to try something, we say, take some measurements, they would take some measurements. So think about this, this is in a building. First of all, I had no idea, and this is something you always learn from these collections, you learn to respect how hard other people's areas are. So we would just say, well, Orlando, you know, can you just take some measurements? We want to check this. He'd say, well, right, there are all these people in their offices, they're working. You know, what am I going to do? And it turns out that the equipment to take the measurements isn't that precise either. So you would wheel this little cart along, you had to kind of go along a straight line, it was taking measurements. You didn't always know exactly where you were, because of course it's critical to know if you're this many feet along this hallway, what the signal is. It was very complicated. So the measurements could not be taken easily. We did take measurements. There was one building we worked on that was actually being constructed. So it was perfect because we went in before the people moved in and we were able to take measurements. But in general, we couldn't do that. We certainly, in Home Depot, could not go in there and, you know, disrupt their business for days on end. I mean, it took weeks to take these measurements. So it was very difficult, and often it was just impractical. So we did the same thing that we had done with the beam line. We reformulated the problem. We said, okay, we can't really model the radio stuff. We can't take very many measurements, but we'll do the best we can. So once again, we didn't just say, we're sorry, can't do anything, it's impossible, good luck, you know. Because they had a technique that they used, which was sort of modeling radio propagation with spheres. You know, you have this transmitter, it, you know, sends things out in a sphere, and each where the power falls off, but using the inverse power law. Of course, it's not accurate, it's really bad, and it doesn't take any account of the different transmissivity of the walls. But, you know, they'd been using that, kind of like the knobbing, okay, but it wasn't very good, so we figured we could do better. So a building is modeled by straight line walls of different materials with different transmission properties. Okay, so of course, we ended up with a building that had a wall like that, okay? So we thought, oh, no, straight lines. But you can, you know, approximate it pretty well with a lot of little bitty straight lines, especially when you know that there's a lot of error. And this worked pretty well, and it even worked pretty well for buildings that weren't rectangular, that had points, you know, because the walls were still straight lines. Okay, now, I can't say enough to praise my colleague Steve Fortune. So he had the job of figuring out how to estimate the power transmitted by this wireless system, and he used ray tracing, which is a hard problem. And if you take it in its most general form, it's way too expensive. If you take each ray and calculate its angle of incidence and how it bounces off and how much power it loses and so on and so forth. But what Steve did is that he sort of said, you know, I can do this, and he did. And his algorithm improved by, I don't know, 3 orders of magnitude, 4 orders of magnitude. Because in order to do what we wanted to do, we had to estimate the received power at any point in a building. Okay, so we had this building, we had this model, we were going to do ray tracing. So, as I said before, this is the same picture. I'm just showing you again that these colors represent the different transmissions. And what was the optimization problem? We were trying to design the system by putting these base stations, which emit the rays, in the best location. So best X, Y, and Z for the number of base stations that would be in the system. And that was important because they were the expensive part. Okay, the other parts of the system were relatively cheap. They wanted to minimize the cost of the base stations if possible, but they wanted to maximize coverage in the building. So what does coverage mean? Coverage means the fraction of the building where the power you would receive on your cell phone was above some threshold. Okay, so if it was above that threshold, it was covered. If it was below that threshold, it wasn't covered. So here's how we calculated a good enough approximation to the coverage. And we found out that it was good enough by using these precious measurements. So we discretized the building with a grid. Now, I know this is trivial conceptually, but if you think about discretizing one of these buildings with walls and funny shapes, I mean, even that is not so easy. Calculate the power at each grid point. Define coverage as the percentage of the building covered above the threshold. Absolutely a naive thing, but it worked. Okay, and at some point you just say, well, it may be naive, but it's good enough for me, and it's good enough for this problem. So you can say, well, coverage can only take on a finite set of values, right? Because if you have 1,000 grid points, it can be, you know, 0, 1/1,000, 2/1,000, I mean. So it's not really a continuous function, coverage, and it's also not continuous mathematically. Some of the buildings, for example, that we dealt with were hospitals, where they would have rooms where you radio waves could not go into the room. So if you moved the base station around that wall, the coverage would change completely, change in a discontinuous fashion. So even if you had ideal models of coverage, it would not be continuous. And the continuity was sort of hard to figure out, depending on the configuration of the building. So we wanted to maximize a function that was unpredictably discontinuous, noisy. I mentioned all these fudge factors, very expensive to calculate. And I said Steve's algorithm was blazingly fast, and it was. But we had to do many, many, many calculations in buildings with thousands of walls. You know, there are an amazing number of walls, even in small buildings. Okay, I mean, some of the ones we dealt with, Home Depot did not have thousands of walls, but others did. And we can't get a high accuracy solution. The way we're calculating coverage, we can't get high accuracy. The model isn't that good, we can't get high accuracy. But luckily, they didn't want a high accuracy solution. Remember I said that some optimization problems, you just want it to be good enough or better enough? They just wanted it to be good enough because they were never going to put in a system where they were just barely covering the building and they'd say fine, because they knew that that was too risky. So there's always a certain element of over-engineering. I remember the first time I discussed optimization with someone about taking off in an airplane. And I said, well, I'm so glad, you know, when they take off, they really punch it. You know, they really want you to accelerate. He said, no. They're trying to find the minimum speed that they can take off and use the minimum amount of fuel. And I said, I hope they've built in some safety factor. I hope they aren't saying, oops, the model is wrong, you know. And of course, real systems where people's lives or profit depend on it, they don't usually mess around. I mean, the airplanes, it's been fine ever since I got that reassurance, but I hadn't focused on the fact that my optimum, which is let's go as fast as we possibly can, was not the same as the airlines. Okay, anyway, we did, and the primary goal was getting a better answer quickly, because this was actually going to be used in an interactive environment where people who were showing, you know, how these wireless systems would work were demonstrating them. So they really couldn't spend a lot of time on this. So we did this using a direct search optimization method designed to optimize functions for which no derivatives are available, and this is an area that I've continued to work on ever since and still am working on. So what about the WISE project? So this went on for months, months and months and months. It was intensive. We met all the time, lively, because it took a long time for us to learn each other's language. You know, Ronaldo would be going on and on about radio, and we would say, we don't know what you're talking about. We would be talking about some math, and he would say, I don't know what you're talking about. We'd start yelling and screaming. You know, it was lively, as they say. And it was very enjoyable. Okay, we really had a good time. We never told our bosses that, of course. We said, oh, we're slaving away on this. Oh, so difficult. But it was really fun. It's one of the most enjoyable things I've done. It, just like the Slack collaboration. And that's partly why these are two things I'm showing you. So everybody got new research results. Okay, Brian did some papers on user interfaces and system engineering. I wrote papers on direct search methods. Steve Fortune wrote papers on fast ray tracing algorithms. And the bosses and the customers were happy. Okay, so these were good things for us. These were good things for us, but this was a company, right? I mean, this was supposed to please our management and please the customers, and they were very happy. And I just want to point out, in these applications, the happiness of your customers, even though it doesn't enter the mathematical formulation, may be the most important thing to optimize. Okay, but it's implicit. Okay, so I just want to show you some of how this turned out. So this is Home Depot. Okay, it's not from the perspective view. It's obviously from the side. So I don't know if you can read this. 81.65% covered at minus 65 dBm. So what we did here is Brian used what's called the hot iron scale, which is, I hope you agree, that it's trivial to see what this means. Okay, so these are the colors. The brighter the color, the more power. If it's not covered at this threshold, it's black. Okay, so you can see, and these are the base stations. So you can see there are four base stations here. There's a lot of information down here. This user interface, the bosses and the customers, they loved it. I mean, you can sort of play with this. We talked about making a computer game where you would optimize coverage in the building, because people like this. So, I mean, you could do some really, let me just say, once you have a mathematical model, you can do some really crazy things. You can put the base stations on the floor. You can put them above this. I mean, I don't want you to think we were wasting our time, but, you know, we did play around with this. So anyway, this is how we started. 81.65%. And by the way, these are kind of where the traditional engineers would have put them. Okay, these four base stations. And you can see 81.65% covered. And you could change the threshold up here. See, there's a little slider. So you can change that. Okay, so after we did optimization, it was 91.1% covered. And you could say, well, it's still not 100% covered, and that's true. But it's much better. Okay, it's much better, and it's at the level of improvement that they were happy with. You know, everyone knew you. I mean, they probably would have added another base station and made sure it's at 100% coverage. But this is the kind of thing that we would get here. So you can see now that there are just a few big black areas, and it's much better. And we've moved the base stations around. And what was interesting is often they would move in ways that the engineers wouldn't have guessed. This is going to remind you of slack, right? They would say, well, your model says, you know, that I should move that there, but I don't believe it. So then we would get Orlando, bless his heart. He would take measurements. He would find out that what had been a big black blob before, now there was coverage. So gradually, people started to believe it. And of course, the model got improved as we went along. There were other anticipated bonuses. WISE, especially the user interface, and I mean that was Brian Kernighan, it allowed the system designers to gain new insights into the physical system, okay? Because once you have, this is the great thing about mathematical models, right? You don't have to build them. You don't have to keep building new buildings and actually move the base stations around. You know, you don't have to have teams of engineers saying, how's this, how's this, how's this, how's this? You just press a button. So the engineers, the system engineers, loved this tool because they could gain new insights into the physical system. So I'm now going to show you the same pictures I showed you before, but now we're going to do what's called strongest base analysis. And see, this is something no one told us about this at the beginning. They just said coverage, coverage, coverage. We've got to have coverage. They're actually interested in what's called strongest base. So this is the first picture. Now what this means is each base station has a color. This is green, yellow, red, blue. And the colors here show which of these four base stations is the strongest at that point. So you'd expect, you know, that the blue would be around this, the green would be around this, the red would be around this. But see, there's some anomalies that are kind of weird. Like, what's this green thing doing here? In the, you know, it goes sort of green, yellow, green, red, green. It turned out that with the model that the radio engineers swore was accurate, it's because it's sort of a straight shot from here, and because of certain properties of the angle of reflection, this got the most power from this base station. Okay, because the red one had to go through these walls. I mean, you know, after the fact, you can look and say, oh, of course, it's because of this. But you'd never expect this picture. Similarly, there's this kind of break here. So these aren't connected. And that's sort of what they had used before, were these cylinders. And then this is the optimal one. So you can see that what it is, has happened now, actually, except for this part here, these are more connected. You know, the strongest base is more like the base station you'd kind of think it would be. And the radio engineers loved this and made a lot out of it. I can't tell you what they made out of it, but they were very happy, and they were very happy to have something they could play with and try out different aspects of the model with. Okay, I'm almost done. So what can we conclude from these two examples? And I said they were my examples, but they're absolutely typical of everybody I know who works on real problems. I don't know if I could convey it without leaping up and down, but I mean, there's such joy for mathematicians in helping to solve real-world problems. And I've already said that when I say solve real-world problems, I don't really mean solve in the sense that you do a math homework problem. You know, you don't write down, this is the answer. Even when you aren't solving the original problem, we didn't solve the commissioning problem, we didn't solve the wireless design problem, we solved something else, and we solved it in a way that most mathematicians would not agree was actually a solution, because it couldn't be solved in a rigorous sense. So the term solved is misleading, solve the problem is misleading. We helped people to get better solutions to real-world problems. And there was tremendous satisfaction to that. We all learned a lot. We all learned new math. We all had a good time, okay? So I just don't want you to think that it's all about the real-world problem. There are always, almost always, I know someone will say, well, wait, what if you're doing this? So almost always opportunities for interesting new math. For example, and these are taken from examples I know of, you can prove theorems. That's the currency of our field, right? Proving theorem. You can show that the problem can be solved exactly in certain special cases. So if you're prepared to simplify it enough or assume certain structure, you can prove that you can solve it exactly. And that can be very important in cases where the one they're interested in it happens to be one of these special cases. Okay, so that's good. Or you can show, I mean, it takes a fiendish mind, but many mathematicians have that, where they always say, so how badly can this perform? Okay, this works well, but how badly can it perform? So you might show that a certain form of the problem will require exponential time to solve with the most commonly used heuristic technique. And I have to tell you, heuristics are fine, but in both these cases, people would come in and say, well, there's this technique that we use that's been around a long time, and you kind of twiddle this, set this to 2.5 times that, do this, this, and this. You know, sometimes you can show that that really is not a good idea. And you could argue with them based on mathematics. Okay, you can say, look, I can show you that if you take this technique that you claim is so great and you apply it to this problem, it's going to run for 6 weeks. You know, most of the people you're dealing with here get that, okay? But they wouldn't necessarily get it if you didn't have a proof, if you didn't have a rigorous proof. And finally, and this is something that happens more and more, you may not be able to solve the problem exactly, but there's a whole family of techniques for showing you can get an approximate solution with accuracy that you can give a bound on in reasonable time. And for most practical applications that I know about, that's usually good enough. Not all applications, but many of them, that's good enough. So there is mathematics that you can do, and it comes out of getting involved in the problem. Okay, now, I started with a song. I'm ending with a song. I don't know, some of you may be too young to recognize the song. So we said, what can we say after we say we're sorry? I said that there are problems that people come to you with. They say, I want to solve this. You would say it's impossible. Turn back to your work. But you don't have to do that. So you can say to them, you can't get what you want always. But if you try sometime, you might find you get what you need. So I think in these cases, the people that were our customers got what they need. They got a solution to their problem, even if they didn't get what they originally wanted. Thank you.